Hello, Mark. The running joke of still in your basement has now gotten so old, but that was the first thing that came to mind when I saw you.
Because I'm still in the basement. Well, I mean, it's actually just because the acoustics here are better, and this is the one day a week when I'm actually at home. Actually, don't say that because people will then try and burgle my house on the other days. No, I'm home all the time, and we have a big dog. So don't go there. But anyway, I'm happened to be home today, so I'm doing it from here. Otherwise, I'd be in the studio with you now that we can get back to work, which is kind of nice.
Thank you for noticing. I mean, this would be the first time, that we could have seen each other, live.
That's
since
true.
Like 2017 or something. As always, I guess the world has kept on spinning since we last spoke. I don't know how I did that. One of the things that has happened that has, of course, gotten a lot of eyeballs on it is what happened in Texas, and they're now have outlawed abortion, or that they've made abortion illegal after 6 weeks. And of course, 6 weeks for a woman to know that she's pregnant is actually very early on. So, bottom line, for a lot of medical professionals, they've outlawed abortion for women, or the option of abortion for women. And then the Supreme Court, in all of their wisdom, decided to not do anything on that particular law. So, I mean, this feels like it's going to, A, go to other states, but B, also get probably pushed before the Supreme Court again in some sort of way. Maybe a different question, but same case, I would think, is going to come before the Supreme Court. It feels like it's not resolved at all yet.
So two observations on this, and I want you to explain some stuff to me, but just start with the observations. So, a couple of years ago when Trump was in power and they launched that TV show, The Handmaid's Tale, there was a lot of sort of like, well, things are going that way. For the past sort of year up until the abortion crusade version 7.0 got launched with the Texas law, we were tightening up on voting. We're tightening up essentially on minorities, right? A lot of which are women. And now basically we've decided that they really can't have an abortion and anybody who helps them can be sued by a private citizen. That's got to be unconstitutional or legally dubious at some level. I'm not entirely sure. Maybe you can explain it. But is this kind of The Handmaid's Tale coming to life? I mean, it's just basically the restriction on women's right to be in public, to vote, to have their voices heard, and now to control their bodies. I mean, this is pretty nuts, right?
Well, and it's confounding. It's not confounding because, of course, abortion is always the top of the list when it comes to social issues for Republicans. But the voting thing is odd. You just wonder why didn't they just go all the way and just try to outlaw it and then force the Supreme Court to really reckon with Roe v. Wade? Although there's the court case that's out there waiting for the court this fall around this question. I mean, if it's the classic sort of incremental, chip away at the law until the law is null and void, they're certainly doing that. But I know there's been the Handmaid's Tale, I just keep hoping that it's not that, but it's certainly veering in that way. I mean, you don't know how much more can really be taken away.
So what's the voting constituency for this? I mean, I don't pay close attention to this, but I was under the impression that a majority of Americans are not terribly upset with current abortion laws and think that it needs an incredible tightening. So what's the electoral payoff to doing this?
Well, I don't know. And I was thinking about this, too, because I thought, well, if the people of Texas just actually start voting, and they can put in a different state legislature, maybe this will actually change. But I mean, if you look at the makeup, and this is just based on superficial demographics, I mean, it's a conservative state. Even when you think about the religiosity or the religious component of the state, it leans pretty conservative in that way. So, I mean, in a lot of ways, if you're an abortion advocate or anti-abortion advocate, Texas is a great pilot for you to see whether you can get this thing through that legislature. And then is it going to be then throughout the South as well? But can the voters of Texas overturn this thing? I don't know. Can they do it with Austin, Dallas, and Houston alone? Probably not. I mean, it's still pretty conservative, especially if you look at who voted for Trump versus Biden in the last presidential.
So is the whole thing about turning the big red states blue effectively bullshit then? Is this another sort of Democratic wish that is just a Democratic wish?
Well, Texas is always the dream of all of people living in New York City, but you don't see it turning anytime soon, especially with exactly your point, the voter laws. I mean, that Greg Abbott is tightening up the screws on that shows exactly that he's not going to let a Georgia type thing happen. So meaning that it changes or is at least purple in some way. So I think Texas is always the dream, but you don't see it changing for a while. I mean, there's always election night. People are like, yeah, it's going to turn blue, but it's hard to see that demographically.
So it's funny, I was on a call to a conference in Hungary. Basically, the mayor of Budapest, who's trying to run against Viktor Orban in November, has this big sort of conference and brings in various worthies to talk about stuff. So we had a discussion of Angrynomics, and one of the people who was there on the call was Martin Wolf from the Financial Times.
Yeah.
And Martin made the point that it's absolutely perplexing from the American, from the European point of view, to understand what's going on in America just now. So to everybody who's not sort of, you know, an authoritarian and happens to think that Hungary is a great place, to have a major broadcaster from a major network come over and camp out and beam back to America that essentially one party rule under an authoritarian guy who mixes basically gerrymandering and bullying to stay in power is the way to go, and we should totally emulate that, is deeply disturbing to them, because they find themselves in this world where they've got to worry about Russia, they've got to worry about China. Are they going to have to worry about the United States? Is the United States effectively turning into one of these semi-authoritarian places with reactionary politics written into the script? And, you know, as somebody who lives here as a citizen, and we don't talk about this. We don't think about it. We don't think about what our politics looks like on the outside. But when the UN comes along, as they did last week, and actually says that the abortion law in Texas is a serious and major human rights infraction, and it's ridiculous that this is going on in a putatively democratic country, the rest of the world goes, yep, and we go, whatever. And it's just very weird to place yourself with this.
I agree. I mean, there was a, I was just reading an article about John Kerry, the climate envoy, or climate change envoy to from the United States, is trying to go around to various nations and hammer out some sort of deal ahead of the Glasgow summit that's coming up. And people said to him, well, why should we negotiate with you? In because in 2 years, it's going to be Trump all over again. And I mean, right. That sort of back and forth, and, you know, this whole question of is America in decline and blah, blah, blah. And you don't quite know where we are on that spectrum. Is it just hyperbole, or is it something more than that? The decline question.
Well, I mean, the decline is the decline is relative to what? An absolute over time. Yeah. I mean, as I like to say to people, you know, Portugal once had a giant empire. It's been in decline since about the 17th century, maybe earlier. Yeah. It's still a really nice place to visit and hang out, you know, so it depends on, you know, what you think. You know, my destiny is to run the world, or maybe my destiny is just to, like, have a nice place to live. So, you know, it can change over time. But yeah, nonetheless, you know, the whole question of decline, that another twist that happened on this call as well, which was interesting, was getting European opinions on what Afghanistan meant.
Yeah.
So the way that this got portrayed in the US media was European allies are perplexed because we pulled out, and it shows a lack of credibility and commitment. That's not what happened at all. They were somewhat perplexed by the pullout, but kind of knew it was going to happen eventually. What they were perplexed at is they expected the Europeans to be happy when they said this. Don't worry, we're never going to do anything stupid and pointless like Afghanistan. Instead, we're going to get all of our resources out of there, rebuild our defense establishment, and get ready to take on China. At which point the Europeans are like, I'm sorry, what? You're basically you want me to be thrilled that you're gearing up for the Third World War, right? That this is the good news? So yeah, there's a lot of miscommunication going on at the moment.
Well, I have something to say about communication, but before I lose it in my head, how you were on the call to Hungary, I'm assuming you're on the, you said you're talking to the guy.
Yeah, I was on Team Jedi. Team Jedi. Okay. I was not on Team Sith.
But he's going to run, the mayor of Budapest is running against Orban.
Yeah.
Will we ever hear from him again, or will Orban put him in prison soon?
No, he's not really the prison guy. He has a lot of popular support. Real wages have risen for a lot of people in Hungary. This is a society whereby it's almost basically impossible to learn the language if you're not, you know, a child and being born there. It's ethnically homogenous. It's no wonder Tucker Carlson loves the place, right? And, you know, he got a lot of support. But, I mean, it is ultimately a kind of that deeply anti-democratic, you know, creeping authoritarian, highly corrupt project.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically other people in the country, particularly, you know, the cosmopolitan elites in the capital city are like, this sucks. But, you know, he has a lot of support out there in the hinterland. Hmm. So this is a common story. We've heard this record before.
Yeah. Well, and to pick up on your miscommunication, it seems like the Biden administration right now has had a lot of miscommunications. I mean, the infrastructure bill if you have fallen asleep, it's still out there. Nancy Pelosi in the House has maybe a margin of one or two votes to get this thing done. Senator Sinema and Manchin have said no to it. I mean, it's hard to know exactly how this thing gets done through both chambers and without it. Without the support of course, the crucial senators. And even though the one or two, maybe three people that Pelosi has are in these, you know, marginal districts, it's hard to know, you know, how she's going to be able to twist their arms. Yeah, it's a suicide run for them,
yeah.
But how is the miscommunication from the Biden administration happen on this Afghanistan and also the French submarine? It just seems like so many misfires on stuff that just... See, I mean, again, sitting from my perch seems pretty straightforward, but how did, you know, all these flubs happen? And especially the infrastructure bill, it's just sitting there waiting. And it's, you know, why it's taken so long and why the president's just getting involved now.
Well, I mean, from my point of view, I mean, it's the classic sucker's move for the Democrats. Every time the Democrats are in opposition, the Republicans blow through the debt ceiling and the Democrats go, okay, fair enough. And the minute they're in charge, no, no more debt. Absolutely, we'll throw the economy off a cliff rather than do this. And, you know, they just play for keeps. And the Democrats always think there's a deal to be done. If you want to get this infrastructure done past, you basically frog march the reluctance into a room and say, what's it going to take one way or the other? Make that happen and then just vote it through. Because if you rely on, you know, maybe one or two Republicans support this, forget
please.
It. It's never going to happen, right? So, you know, ultimately... Is this going to be, this is the test case, right? If they get past the debt ceiling and they get this passed, it's akin to Obama being able to do Obamacare. Because it's like a big singular thing. We've done a thing, right? Now we can basically stop and wait to get smashed in the face during the midterms. Right? But if they don't do this, that's it.
Yeah, but exactly. At least if they get smashed in the face, they have something to show for it. You know, a broken nose or something. Oh, gosh. And then... I just seeing these pictures of what's happening at the border. So first of all, I was, you know, prepping for this and trying to understand what is exactly happening at the border. And, you know, I'd heard, and then I thought, oh gosh, it's just, you know, the sort of the story that we've seen throughout the summer, but then it involved Haitians. And I was so confused about what was happening. And it turns out a lot of people are very confused about Haitians traveling about, you know, a couple thousand miles to that particular place in the border because they'd heard that the U.S. was going to let people in. I mean, it's just kind of heartbreaking. And I think the U.S. has let in a few hundred families and they're being placed throughout Texas. But yet another sort of what is the administration doing on this? It seems like they're following similar stuff to what the Trump administration was doing.
Well, yes, but, you know, without gloating about it. I mean, you know, it's not like, hey, we threw more kids into cages, right?
Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, the southern border, regardless of who's in power, is going to become just a lightning rod for American politics for the next God knows how long. You've got societies, Nicaragua, El Salvador, the combined stresses of economic collapse, climate change, the pressure on traditional farming and traditional farming communities. You've already got climate refugees. Then you have places like Haiti, which are appallingly governed, have been through so many crises and natural disasters that people are basically saying, I'm done. I got to get out of here. I do not want to be here. So you're going to have that migrant pressure. And, you know, we're at a point now where there's no one on the other side of the debate in the United States saying, yes, more immigration. That's what we need. It's a good thing. That's what America does. Like the rest of the developed world, they've basically said, nah, we're good. That's fine. That's it. No more. And trying to make that kind of like, you know, traditional progressive case for mass immigration, I literally can't think of a single successful, quote unquote, I mean in electoral terms, government that's actually on that side of the debate. Yeah. The world is shut.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Biden was at UNGA, United Nations General Assembly meeting this week and, you know, gave a speech that probably no one listened to. And I didn't either, but I did hear a few snippets of it. And what I thought was interesting was him saying that we have to be able to show that government can do something and we have to be able to show that we're not just some sort of hollow thing that it's just a White House, you know, and no one's endorsed. This is a terrible image that I'm drawing, but in any case, and I thought about that in regards to the what's happening at the border in terms of all the U.S. has is human capital and the opportunity to maybe be the next Mark Zuckerberg. And I, you know, that I think that's probably a lot, those potential opportunities. But I mean, in order to actually show the world that we are doing that, we have to not be closed. And, you know, you saw a little bit of it maybe with the Afghan, with the transporters from the Afghanistan. But it just seems like that's all we have right now. And can't we do better?
Well, from the point of view of the Trump coalition, right, essentially what have you got? You've got cosmopolitan elites who still care more about importing foreigners than they do about upskilling or doing anything to help the opioid crisis that their own citizens face.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just it's a very, very hard sell. How do you explain? No, but really, economies thrive on knowledge, and that means a diversity, and that means human capital versus my where I live and everyone I know is jobless and, you know, teetering on the point of indigence and drug addiction. Well, what have you done for us lately? We're actually the citizens.
Yeah.
And, you know, just doubling down on that, that's basically that's where that pressure comes from. The progressive answer to that, which is, of course, sort out both issues, is actually very hard to do.
Yeah, and I know even Bernie with his like dental as part of, you know, like we need to have seniors need to have a dental plan. I mean, you know, he's been on about that for 500 years and we still have yet to see anything come from that. So the Fed announced something.
They announced that they would begin tapering their asset purchases come November. So what does that mean? It means that they won't be buying bonds and other stuff from the private sector and flooding the economy with so much cash. That may lead to a cooling effect. It may lead to a slight rise in interest rates. Is it sort of going to be huge in the grand scheme of things? Not for the United States itself. What I would worry about it is the last time they did this, they got into what was called the taper tantrum. And the taper tantrum was, yeah, because basically if the United States raises interest rates at home in a world in which everybody's at zero, all the money in the world flies into the United States because you get a higher return. So if you think about this from the point of view of developing economies, it's really horrible. So when the United States cuts to zero in a moment of crisis, everybody pushes money out in the developing world looking for any type of yield because they tend to have higher interest rates. So you junk it in there. Then when the United States says, crisis is over, time to normalize, that pushes up interest rates. All that money goes flying out of these countries and you have multiple currency crises happening all at once. So this speaks to the fact that really, because the world is a dollar economy, the Fed is the global central bank, but it only officially has a US mandate. So it's talking to the US financial audience and basically saying, we get it, you're a bit worried about inflation, don't worry, we think we're on the road to recovery, we're going to stop doing all the stuff we do that juices of the economy, we're going to slow it down a bit. Well, if that leads to rising rates, American savers might go, great, I get more than the square root of nothing in my savings. But at the same time, you know, all that money that flew into Latin American economies, if it comes flying out, then whoops, currency crisis, import collapse, bad things happen. So the global shocks to American policy is something the Fed's not allowed to look at, but it thinks about it. So it's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, as usual.
Is Jerome Powell, do you think he'll continue on as Fed chair?
I can't imagine why not. Unless he basically says, like many people of his age, hang on, I've got a 401k packed with cash. I'm off to the beach, right? You know, and all, God love him if he decides that.
Yeah.
But no, I think he's in it basically for the longer haul in that regard.
It seems like a really thankless job.
Well, I mean, I call it the leader of last resort. I mean, you know, love it or hate it, and yes, its asset purchases increase inequality, and yes, it leads to a huge stock market boom that only benefits those that have got stocks, which is a tiny minority of Americans, really, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, all things considered, it's the last functional bit of the U.S. state because Congress is completely broken.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they also, because of the role of the dollar, actually take a kind of global look at things and try and think about things holistically in a joined up way. So, you know, better that than not that.
And actually, this is making me feel better because, you know, that the U.S. is on decline and we're terrible and or not terrible, but they were on decline, have nothing. Well, now I forget that it's a dollar based economy. So we still have we still have that, too. Speaking of, you said, you know, global economics, what's going on in China with Evergrande? What's the importance of that?
So Adam Tooze's newsletter had a great sort of line on this, right? People look at China and see different things. And this is a great example of this, whereby Evergrande is the Lehman Brothers of China. Well, no, it's not. And this is going to be this huge crisis. Well, maybe it is, maybe it is. But whatever happens, it's going to happen, quote unquote, as they like to say, with Chinese characteristics. Now, look, imagine this was a Western firm. What would it be? It would be as if sort of some of the biggest asset managers in America decided to become the biggest landlords in America. and then they build tons and tons of houses in second tier cities. And that's great for GDP numbers. It's great for the local property developers. It's great for the party cadres who can report high GDP scores because they built all this housing, right? Everything's great. Except the price to income ratio is on all the expensive cities, the growth cities, where everybody wants to be, your Shanghai, etc., are truly astonishing, right? So if New York is 12 to 1 on income, Beijing is 50 to 1 on the average income. Right, it's completely nuts. So you got have the Xi administration, which has actually now said, oh, by the way, you may remember, we are communists. And what they've kind of done, I think, is they've looked out at the American economy and said, all right, so what do we get if we go down this route? We get about an extra 1,000 billionaires. 100 of them become difficult politically. Mm. They start to poison and pollute your politics and buy your politicians. You get eye-watering inequality. One of them builds a spaceship for a jolly. You're doing nothing about climate change. You can't pass any legislation. I don't think we want to go there. Time to rein these people in, right? So put this very big, teetering, highly levered property developer in the middle of this. What is it that they'll do? More than likely, they're not going to go, well, we'll look at the good assets and the bad assets and put the bad assets in the bad bank. There's no Western playbook for there. The entire board of directors will disappear, never to be heard from again. Seriously. That will be number one. Any of the suppliers to these firms, like the local building firms that employ 10,000 people that build all the apartments in a city you've never heard of, they will probably be taken care of in the sense of insulated from the failure of the creditor to pay them what they owe. And then whatever good assets are left will basically be taken over by the People's Bank of China. They'll put that into some kind of special part of the balance sheet, just like we did in the financial crisis. We invented this thing called Maiden Lane and then chucked all the mortgages into it. They'll do something similar like that. And then they'll use their gigantic foreign exchange reserves to cushion the blow. And then they will use that as an excuse to go in and really push down on the property sector and restructure a lot of the firms and take a lot of the heat out of the market. That's the sort of that's the playbook that they're searching for. Whether they will get there or not is a slightly different story, because it's very hard to do that.
Well, and that's interesting. One of the disappearing of people, it made me think there's this famous Chinese actress. I don't know if you saw this, Zhao Wei, who's been totally disappeared. Like she's been disappeared off the internet. They totally swept her out to who knows where. And so it's just like thinking about this in connection to like the pop culture people in China and how they're really cracking down on their social media, on what they say, their travel, like all of this sort of stuff is an interesting, I don't know if this is a moment of when they're looking internally and trying to, I don't know, shore up any stuff for the oncoming World War III. I mean, it's just an interesting moment of why it is that they're now really concerned with what their actors and, you know, other cultural, you know, global sorts of people are doing.
Well, I think this is part of, you know, Xi's sort of, by the way, honestly, we really are communist move, which is what are the point of markets? The point of markets are to allocate goods more efficiently. All right, are we allocating them in an efficient way if basically we end up with higher inequality than the United States? So who are these people that are causing problems? Who's giving people these kind of aspirational lifestyle things which are completely unattainable to most people? Oh, it's all these social media people. Right, well, you know, let's clamp down on that. I mean, you can follow the logic quite clearly. You just have to think in that frame.
Yeah.
What is it ultimately you want these markets for? We like markets because they make us rich and damn the torpedoes. Like, there's been a shift in China, and the shift is essentially on the question of what do you think markets are for?
Yeah, right. And she's showing that he's not a Deng Xiaoping either, right? On the question of torpedoes, Blythe, U.S. and France, I mean...
That was brilliant. Yeah. Very good.
But here's one more. We don't call them freedom fries for nothing either, you know? I mean, now that the U.S. and France are on the outs, maybe they'll change French fries back to freedom fries. It is a weird thing with the submarine deal and that France is so pissed off. I mean, yeah, it was a lot of money. It is a lot of money. But it just seems really, pulling the ambassador to the U.S., Biden is having trouble getting Macron on the phone. But another mis-messaging thing is, did the U.S. not think, oh, this is going to piss them off and maybe we should talk to them beforehand to let them know this is going to happen? What's your take on this?
On that one, I really don't know whether it was simply cut them out of the deal and don't tell them and spring it on them. or whether it was mismessaging. To me, I'm just more concerned as to what this thing is for. I posted this on Twitter, my Twitter feed. There's this fabulous one-minute outtake from an Australian comedy series. They do a cabinet meeting, and they're saying, all right, and it's before the announcement, right? They're just talking about, so we've got this big expenditure on defence. The Prime Minister's going to have to defend this. It's incredibly vague terms. General, can you fill this in for us? And it says, so basically it says when you spend $60 billion a year for whatever, right, defending against a regional power, who is it? Well, can't really say. All right, if I say the word, can you nod? And they go, China, and they all start nodding, right? And it says, so what's the rationale for this? Well, it's to defend our trade routes. Okay, that's great. So who's our number one trading partner? China. So you're spending all this money to defend your trade routes against the people that you have trade routes with? Yes. Right. I mean, literally, it's kind of like, OK, so what's the strategic rationale for here? Look into the fine print of this. The first of these new submarines the Australians are going to get, 2040.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing we know from military contracts is that that'll be 2050.
Right.
Right. So by the time that I'm probably dead, they might get their first submarine. And if we just continue to screw up on, you know, climate crisis, adaptation, the whole lot, then Australia will be basically uninhabitable. I don't care about the submarines. So it's this question of sort of, OK, where is America's head in this moment?
Yeah.
You know, it's like we've got out of Afghanistan. Now we can really tool up against China, right? Right at a moment when China's turning inwards to prepare itself from what it sees as the inevitable conflict with the US, which is really heartening. And it goes gung-ho with Britain. Like, Britain, come on. They've got one aircraft carrier with no planes on it, right? And a handful of submarines. You've got France, who's now out of the picture. And then you've got the Australians who are going to be given new American submarines. And somehow in 2050, this is going to be relevant. What are we doing?
I know.
What is this? Why are we not just turning around to the Australians and saying, look, ultimately, your country is a giant carbon-polluting global menace with a really good PR department. So you need to actually, if you're going to trade with China, you need to trade something other than more things that add to the climate crisis. Can we talk about that? But instead, no. Nobody in Australia has that conversation. We're not having that conversation. As usual, we're just ignoring the real dangers in front of us and then inventing fantasy ones.
Yeah. One interesting thing I thought that came out of this was that the UK had negotiated its own deal, or not its own deal, but it's like the US, the UK and something. And so I just thought one thing coming out of Brexit was that the UK is now its own entity. It doesn't have, you know, a parental EU sitting over it. So I don't know if that's a win for Great Britain, you know, and thinking about countries on the decline, maybe, you know, is it on the upswing now?
It's a win for imperial nostalgia. You know, yeah. we are back at the top, we're back. And you have one aircraft carrier with no planes on it. I don't think China's basically wetting themselves over this one. You know, in 1957, I think it was, Britain basically ceased its military deployments east of Suez. And that was when it was a much bigger, more powerful country. Now, at a time, you know, where Brexit basically pulls you out of a free trade zone so you can sign more free trade agreements, we're basically expanding our geopolitical reach as our geopolitical size gets smaller and smaller. I got a friend of mine in London who's writing a book about how nostalgia screws up Britain, and I think he's completely right. It's always this imaginary of like sometime in the past, then if we just get back to what we were there, it was so much better.
Yeah.
And this, the foreign policy stuff to me really seems to be some kind of like pre-East of Suez, we're a global power. And it's like, no, you're not. Stop it. You're not helping anyone with this.
That's such a good point. You feel like, so, like, just thinking about the Texas abortion law or some of the social issues, it's such a nostalgia of like when women knew their place,
right?
And
Carrie, when you knew your place,
exactly,
and I controlled your body,
right? And you
what
and
a
I didn't vote,
idea.
Right? And all of those those amazing things, right? So, but in the end, I don't know I guess when I think about like the number of things that have happened over the past few weeks, Afghanistan. And what's happening with the border and France, it just seems like, do any of these things matter for the presidential election or the midterms? Probably not. But it just adds to this overall like sense of like the Biden administration, as you said, like what are they doing right now?
Yeah, no, I mean, I hear this all the time. This, and the minute anybody mentions Anthony Blinken, who's running the foreign policy of the Biden administration, it's sort of like, it's the most talented team, and you hear all these sort of things. And I'm like, you got to be, what are they doing? They're planning for the Third World War, and they're trying to enlist the Aussies. How is that helping anyone? I mean, it's just bizarre. The whole thing's weird. But my turn to segue.
Oh, yeah, please do.
So from the bizarre and weird to the utterly stupefyingly dull, the German election.
Oh, that was a good one. That was very good.
Thank you. Thank you.
But wait, I saw a headline on this that I think it was the person who's in who's running number one right now. And I want to make sure to get, because it's such a great German name, Olaf Scholz. Schloss, is that right?
Schultz.
Oh, sorry. Anyway, but that they were, he had been running an ad that said something to the effect of that he was Angie the Second and that he had what it took to lead the country, even though he was a man. So in stark contrast to what's going on.
So he used the gendered term Kanzlerin to basically suggest that basically he could be as good as a female chancellor in a sense. The whole thing's, the country will never go over Merkel. I mean, Merkel appealed to the culture of the search for stability at all costs in German society. And she even had this electoral symbol where she did this sort of thing.
Oh, the rhombus, like the Merkel rhombus.
Yeah, the rhombus, right? You know, sort of like stability of the rhombus, right? Merkel was once asked what she's most proud of in Germany, and she said hermetically sealed windows. No, I'm quite saying that.
No, right,
I've got
them
in the house. They're amazing. But I wouldn't say that would be the best thing about my country if I was pushed, right? But anyway, it's that sort of like, you know, Kleinburger mentality, as they say, sort of like small town mentality, even though they're a big economy that causes so much of the issues. And literally nobody who's running has any sort of scope, apart from possibly the Greens, for getting out of the sort of various ruts that they've built themselves into. Scholz leads the SPD. The SPD at one point were down to below 20%. They're now up at about 27. Nobody of all the different parties has more than 30%. So inevitably you end up with yet another big coalition of parties that nobody voted for, whereby you get your own version of gridlock, because the FPD want tax cuts and the Greens want to abolish the debt brake so they can do green investment, and the SPD care about old people but there isn't enough money because they do. So you just end up doing nothing. So it's essentially, it's another four to five years of stasis comes out of this.
But I love that you use the word stability, because that seemed to be, again, this is from, you know, reading the German election filtered through the American press, of that stability is what Germany wants, and that actually to have a charismatic leader harkens back to, you know, the bad times.
Yeah, when, absolutely.
And so stability is sexy.
They're still terrorized by Weimar.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you ever look at how Germany reforms any of its institutions, it does so incrementally, and it usually does so by kind of building parallel institutions. I'll give you an example. About 15, 20 years ago, there was an idea that the university system was crap because none of their universities got in the top 50 in rankings. Hmm. Personally, I think that's because the rankings are crap, but nonetheless, you know, they go onto this. So then it was, well, clearly the solution is to be more like America. So we need to have assistant professors and associate professors and all that sort of stuff. Now, absolutely, the German system is literally medieval. The way it works is you have this like Herr Dr. von Professor at the top, and then there's two or three assistants behind him who's in their 40s, and then there's a whole bunch of post-PhDs, the Mitarbeiter. And you basically run a lab, even if you're like in a social science department or humanities department. It's all very top-down and hierarchical. And if the person at the top's good, and they energize it, whatever, it can be amazing. But like when that person goes, these things often fall apart. It's like a little medieval, you know, monarchy type stuff. So yes, would the American system be better? Absolutely. So rather than confronting the universities and saying, right, we're done, we're going to do something else, they started to pick minor universities that were off the radar and shower them with money and bring this new system in and give them loads of hires, because you were building these parallel institutions, right? You didn't want to upset what you've got. Weimar, ghost of Weimar, right?
Yeah.
So what you do is you build these parallel institutions and hope that all these Herr Doctors retire over time.
Uh-huh.
But as usual, they got halfway through this and then kind of got cold feet, abandoned the experiment, and now they're stuck on this sort of weird hybrid system that pleases nobody.
But did the ones that they're trying to bring up, did they have like higher quality? Or
a lot of them were Germans who were trained in the United States who came back to Germany to take these jobs, and then when the whole thing started to go south, they all left again.
Okay, yeah, it seems like not really reaching the goal. Of what
so I mean, you know, you could rinse and repeat for different industries. I mean, you know, the car industry is still making diesel engines. I mean, for God's sake, it's over. Right? But no, there's a future for this. The other guy, Laschet, right, is known as Mr. Coal. He wants Germany to open a coal mine. Like now, you're like, which bit of you can't live in the past did you miss the memo on? And, you know, so that's part of, so hence stability. The one thing we'd agree on, don't change anything ever.
It seems like we're against coal now, but maybe we're not, because as we talked about the last one, like, you know, I mean, well, Joe Manchin, big coal from big coal country, but also that I can't, someone, you know, has called for 30 more years of coal operation in the U.S., so.
China, however, they came out 2 days ago and said no more coal in their Belt and Road Initiative. They will no longer fund the development of coal outside their borders, which, you know, people are like, well, that's because they were bad and they were doing lots of this. Well, you know, remember that 80% of all the funding for coal worldwide is not coming from China. So in actual fact, China is taking a very progressive step in comparison to what Western finance is doing on China, despite all the lip service about ESG.
Can I just ask a clarifying question? Are the roads, the bridges, and the belts, isn't it the opposite? I always get confused on this. And so, or am I totally, you're looking at me like.
I'm just looking at you like, I you know, they could have called it the Gina Davis Memorial Fund for building shit. And I wouldn't have actually thought, is that really about Gina Davis? And you're actually asking me about, is the belt a bell and is the a road? I literally have no idea what
I think
mean
it's
by
like
that.
The opposite. And I'm always like, well, who named this thing? Like, it should, if the road is should be a road and the belt should be a bridge.
There is actually, I think at the founding conference and the founding documents, there is actually an explanation of this, that like somehow the road is something and the belt is something. And I literally have no idea what they meant by that. I'm just not big on, I'm really not big on metaphors in general, unless I'm the one who's making them up.
Well, of course, of course. Well, I laughed at this, and I don't know if you saw this picture of Bolsonaro, who is also New York for UNGA. And the word was that because he was unvaccinated, he was unable to dine inside. And was the picture was taken of him on the sidewalk eating pizza, as all good New Yorkers do. But then I thought, maybe he's just eating on the street. Do we have any evidence that he's actually denied entry to a restaurant? But nonetheless, I thought it gave me a little bit of a laugh.
Well, it creates an interesting dilemma for local government, doesn't it? Because if you let him in, then basically everybody else in New York will be like, hey, Bolsonaro, you know, I get in as well, right? So you have to do that. But at the same time, if you do that, then, you know, it's kind of, wow, you're saying to people, you really are saying to people, you need to be vaccinated to play, right? There's an interesting subtext in that move, irrespective of Bolsonaro himself.
But I was impressed people actually even recognized him, because I was like, wait, is he the guy in the white shirt or the cream shirt? You know, when they were standing next to his aides. And then one other, just to end on a light note, is that Harry and Meghan will be in town in early October for like a global citizen sort of thing. So it's their
sorry, in town being where?
New York, sorry. Is there any other town?
Like, yeah. Well, I thought you meant Providence for a minute.
Yeah. So they'll be in town. They'll be in New York, and it's their first, you know, first public visit or first public outing since they had their second kid. So, you know, this is big, major news.
So remember about 2 years ago or 3 years ago when Harry and Meghan was like starting to become a thing and we started talking about it?
Yeah.
I think back in the day I said, just wait. What's going to happen is all this is going to go hell in a handbasket. And he's going to bugger off the road to Hollywood. And he's going to write a book called Growing Up Royal When You're Not or something like this. And the cat will be finally set amongst the pigeons. And that will basically be, you know, how they're going to make this play. And it looks like it's coming down exactly as I have foreseen.
And you don't like to do the prediction game either. And yet, in this one, you're spot on.
I keep getting them right, exactly. Yeah. I think the giveaway was, if you go back to the wedding, if you remember the wedding, and the sheer discomfort of the British upper classes dealing with the sort of, you know, an American minister, an American African-American minister, and the message, which was that love is the one universal and we should be open in our embrace of love as the dominant sort of virtue that we should have, which is a lovely message. And just watching all these people sort of shrinking back at the very idea that, like, this is what it's become. This is the end, you know. And I just remember looking at these faces and going, this is not going to go well.
Americans and their emotions. Well, it was great to see you as always. And I think we'll probably be back because the world will keep moving and we'll have stuff to talk about.
One would certainly hope so. And in fact, you know, we're in the same town. So maybe we could actually even do a face-to-face
next time would be
amazing.
It'd be incredible. Well, thank you. And thank you all for listening.
See you all soon.
Bye.